Well, a reminder that the transit of the planet Mercury happens today. This is when the planet crosses in front of the sun. It's visible, weather permitting, for about 6 hours or thereabouts. Abrams Planetarium here at MSU has telescopes set up until about 2:30 p.m., and Mercury will just be a speck moving across the disk of the sun. But one of the telescopes apparently allows you to look directly at the sun. You don't get that opportunity too often. But today is one of those days until about 2:30 at Abrams Planetarium at Michigan State University. Current state here on Monday. Glad you're back. It's the 9th of the month. I'm Mark Bayshore. Tonight, the Lansing City Council is expected to vote on a proposal to hire outside legal assistance to investigate the payout of a former city attorney. Janine McIntyre spent about 3 years as city attorney. In February, she signed a separation agreement with the Bernero administration that authorized a payment of about $160,000. No one involved with the agreement has said what triggered McIntyre's departure. The city has said it's been unable to locate a copy of the agreement. Our first guest says she intends to vote against this proposal tonight. Kathy Dunbar is an at-large member of the Lansing City Council. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mark.
Thank you for being here. You've told me and others on the council that you intend not to support this move to hire an attorney to learn more. Why not?
Well, I think at this point what we've discovered from the memo from Dykema, who helped negotiate this, and from past experience, we aren't going to get any more information by hiring an outside attorney than we already have. There's a confidentiality clause in the separation agreement that prohibits either side that negotiated from disclosing any of the details of the separation.
How would you respond to a Lansing taxpayer, though, who said, well, a constituent of yours who says,
sure,
hey, even if an attorney might not be able to crack the confidentiality clause, this is not transparency. We're entitled to know why and how $160,000 of our money got spent.
Oh, that's easy.
So go for it and find out what
sure
you can. Well, I mean, what would you say to somebody who said
well,
that?
Well, first of all, I would say that, one, we negotiate settlements in workers' comp cases all the time as a council. We do it behind closed doors in closed session. When we come out on the floor and we disclose the amount that we've settled on, we don't disclose their name, much less the reason for the settlement. It's all confidential. And that's an employee issue. That is something under charter that we have the ability to do as a council. That is granted to us by the charter. Employee separations and employment management issues are handled by the mayor. That's also in the charter. We don't have the ability under the charter to handle anything like civil litigation. Now, this didn't rise to the level of litigation. There is no complaint. There was no charges. There was no... We don't know. We don't know what the issue was. But what we do know is that the folks who were involved in the negotiations decided that the possibility of litigation could end up costing the city a whole lot more than it did, and that this was the best way out for the city. Now, I will tell you this. We did change, and everyone on council voted on this. We changed the whole buyout system so that, you know, on contract, people compare this to the Peter Lark issue. And I have to come back and say that that's completely apples and oranges. Peter Lark had a 5-year contract and basically was bought out of the remainder of his 5-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
She had a 1-year contract, and her salary was about $150,000 before she was the HR director. And then she had that $40,000 addition on that. So essentially, you know, if you want to talk about the $80,000 of that was the actual payout of her time accrued. And the other 80, which was negotiated, ends up being roughly what her year would be to have bought out.
Mm.
It's not unusual.
I want to play a bit of Judy Brown Clark's comments from Friday on this program and follow up with a question. Here is Judy Brown Clark.
You don't have a severance pay without cause. You don't pay somebody's health insurance for the remainder of the year without cause. You don't make a comment as relates to it's in the best interest. It's not, you know, politically correct, but it's a business decision without cause. So it represents more than just the separation of Ms. McIntyre. And if, you know, and so obviously some of us are more interested than others. I am very interested, and I think it represents something that needs some clarity and transparency.
So according to Judy Brown Clark, there is clearly cause in her mind. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts are, it is not, and I don't know if you had a chance to ask this last week, but from every instance that I've seen, and even quotes in the local papers recently, folks are speculating that she's running for mayor next year. So, of course, if there's a scandal, if there's a speculation of scandal, I mean, there are certain folks on council who would prefer to have that known rather than not known, because it's going to fuel any platform that they have. Now, I will say this, you know, if there, the idea that this was maybe a policy issue versus a business issue, if that's where we want to go with that, like the mayor said, it's not good politics, but it was good business for the city, because it probably saved us an exposure of a lot more money in his mind or in Dykema's mind, then change the policy. If the way that the policy is written right now is we only have say over, you know, workers' comp or civil litigation or settlements like that, then change the law, change the rule by which, you know, we have a problem. Right now, legally, we don't have a say in this matter.
Doesn't it suggest, though, that something unethical happened and that it's the public's dime that's ended up being $160,000 of public money has become a part of this?
It doesn't suggest that something unethical happened. It suggests that there could have been litigation. We don't know what the outcome of that litigation might have been. If there was, there are people who file lawsuits all the time who make money off of the settlements, because it ends up costing companies, municipalities more money in the end to actually go to court, do depositions, pay lawyer fees than it would to actually settle. We do that with workers' comp cases all the time. We get a financial risk of the actual cost of the involvement of lawyers over time and the estimated time involved with the settlement, and we mitigate that risk by offering a settlement. And that's what we bring out on the floor, and we never let anybody know who was involved in that or what the issue was.
Kathy Dunbar is an at-large councilwoman on the Lansing City Council. We're talking about a proposal expected to be voted on tonight, whereby the city council would hire an outside attorney to investigate the reasons and terms of a separation agreement between the city and former city attorney Janine McIntyre. Do you know what led to Janine McIntyre's departure?
I don't. All of us wish we did. If what I believe is there was a breakdown in the working relationship, that's all I can speculate. And for whatever reason, I don't know why she hired an attorney. I don't know why she was on FMLA. But that's hers to know, and it's private. We don't disclose anybody's FMLA reasons.
As you pointed out, in addition to her role as city attorney, she also functioned as interim, I believe, interim head of human resources.
Yes, the mayor placed her there.
It turns out she left the city altogether at around the same time that her pay was cut. Isn't that how it unfolded? And if I'm right about that, is that relevant here, do you think?
If it was to her, I don't know. I mean, you can speculate. We can all speculate. It did happen around the same time. That's the facts. You can't. The problem here is that everybody, it's human nature. When you don't know, you want to fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. And people tend to fill in the blanks with the most salacious, speculative, you know, possibilities imaginable. All we know right here for a fact is that she separated. She went on FMLA. They negotiated and she got paid out approximately what a year's worth of her salary would have been had she been in that contract. And that is how we separate from our executives.
Joe Abood has been functioning as city attorney. How long should the city have an interim-only agreement with its attorney?
I don't know how it's been done in the past. Joe is a fantastic attorney. I really enjoy having him there. It's really up to the mayor to make an appointment at this point. We confirm. We don't choose the city attorney, so he would have to make the decision to change. But, I mean, our office is functioning under Joe, so I don't know what the length of time would be. I don't know if there's one. I don't think there's one mandated in the charter. I know that the interim status was only, I think, until the end of this month. So whether he gets extended or the mayor makes an appointment is yet to be seen.
Do you expect this outside attorney proposal to come to a vote tonight? We're led to believe it's going to be put on the agenda.
It's not on the agenda right now.
No.
It's up to be discussed in the Committee of the Whole, which is not, I mean, maybe if something moves out of Committee of the Whole, it will go to the floor. I don't expect it to pass.
Okay. Let's shift gears here. Where do you stand on the proposal for a pot shop moratorium and a marijuana ordinance? There will be another public hearing on this on Thursday, I take it.
Yes. Yeah, I am. First of all, I'm going to make clear, I'm a supporter of medical marijuana. And I don't know that there's anybody on the council that's not a supporter of the concept of medical marijuana. What we're dealing with right now is a proliferation of shops throughout the city in a density like is unseen in any other community in Michigan right now. So I am not opposed to the moratorium. I do think that we need to find a better way to regulate. Right now, we have a lot of people are arguing we have an ordinance on the books, but we were told by a prior city attorney that when that was passed, it was unenforceable. And we need to clean that up and basically create an ordinance that comports with state law.
Not opposed to a moratorium. You would vote for the plan that's in the Public Safety Committee right now?
Yes, I would vote for the moratorium. I don't know on the ordinance. I have to see what the details would be in the final version.
There were a couple of busts last week, I guess. Hydro World and Danny Trevino, federal charges. Here is that.
Now, let's separate that from the local ordinance, because obviously there that wasn't an attack on medical marijuana provision in general. That was very targeted toward a single owner at several of his locations.
But an ordinance would be relevant there, wouldn't it?
If you're going to move
on an ordinance, wouldn't that be connected?
No, I don't even know what the charges are so far. There are no charges that have been brought against him. So I don't know what they found. I don't know what they're planning to, when they're planning to issue indictments. I have no idea what's going on. I've been following that. I actually follow Danny's page on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I've been watching to see what the posts are from other providers and other folks on that matter. So,
will the council vote on a new budget tonight?
Yes.
I'm led to believe there hasn't been a lot of sound and fury associated with the budget this year. Is that accurate?
It always happens on the last minute. You'll hear it tonight. Stay tuned.
Well, there isn't a deficit again.
No, it's fantastic. So. We are actually in a surplus year again. We get to put money into the rainy day fund. We can do a little bit more. Now I caution anybody that thinks that we're out of the red, permanently. We gotta set money aside responsibly. But yeah, I look forward to it. I'm sure that there'll be some amendments tonight, but
Kathy Dunbar is our guest. She's an at-large city councilwoman on the Lansing City Council. The Lansing School District's pathway promise millage passed. You were a supporter?
I was.
Why?
Because it's important for the future of our kids that they. I don't want to see a Detroit school system. I don't want to see buildings falling apart. We've got some aging infrastructure that needs to be fixed, and the idea that we have some future plans for our kids is fantastic.
Oh, some said it wasn't big enough. I've seen reports of that. Would you have voted in favor of a bigger millage?
I would have.
Is that right?
Yeah. I don't think everybody would have, but I would have.
I know the pilots have been an issue recently on the city council, payment in lieu of taxes.
Yes.
Remind our listeners what's going on there and how you feel about it.
Well, right now there is a proposed moratorium on pilots. It's particularly, it was instigated because of some issues with lower income housing that came up that qualified for pilots or requested pilots for their grant applications to MSHDA. And MSHDA looks more favorably on their funding sources for low income development, not just low income, but affordable housing. I'm going to put it that way, because I think of low income is more of a description of people, and affordable housing is the description of the actual real estate. So what we had was some council members who really think that we need to look at alternatives outside of the city for affordable housing. I have a different bent. I don't like concentrations of affordable housing all in one single area, especially in a community that is already depressed, that doesn't have resources, that doesn't have transportation options, that doesn't have retail, commercial, or employment options for folks. I think that that's pretty much siloing people into a scenario that they can't see an outcome from. But I do agree with low-income housing dispersed across the city in different economic areas. That like Old Town was the issue that we had most recently with the Sabori project, and that was voted down. And I think, unfortunately, I think that the idea that the Third Ward has a majority of the low-income housing right now, that's true. We're not putting it in the third ward. We're putting it in an area that's, you know, up and coming. And I know that some of the council folks said, we don't want to put low-income housing in an area that's up and coming. I think you run into a very, very dangerous issue there when you say that this area is too good for poor people. And, you know, you end up in a possibility of gentrification. That's what happened in Detroit. We took all the folks that lived downtown on the waterfront, moved them out, built high rises, and we displaced everybody. And then we had the silo.
Has the city of Lansing been deprived of legitimate revenue because of pilots in the past, though?
Here's the thing. We have a population that has a certain income level that can afford a certain amount of housing, and they deserve good housing. They deserve safe housing. And if those folks, there's a glut right now. I'm going to say this. There's a study that was done recently. Dr. Suk Kyung Kim over at MSU did a study for the Greater Lansing Housing Coalition. And it found that we are seriously lacking in safe, affordable housing for folks with disabilities, with seniors, low-income families. And when I say low-income families, I mean like a family of four that makes $40,000. These are the working poor. This isn't the severely poor. That's the working poor. And we need those opportunities. And I think that when we start to say that we're not going to put them in places that are too high income for them, that we run into a lot of issues. And I will tell you that on the pilot right now, I know that the way that it's written right now, it would carve out an exception for disabilities and for seniors. The pilot moratorium would say, except for, you know, pilots that affect these folks. Well, we have a human rights ordinance here in town, and I wrote it years ago, and it protects a lot more than just seniors and folks with disabilities. It affects low income. It affects all kinds of folks. And I think that when you carve out and say only one certain type of protected class gets to have this housing as opposed to others, you run into possible issues with human rights.
Kathy Dunbar is an at-large city councilwoman on the Lansing City Council. I appreciate your coming in today.
Thank you very
Thanks
much for
being
having me.
Here. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea is known for staging world premieres of new plays. Their latest is called Gaps in the Fossil Record. It was written by actor Matt Lesher, a Michigan native and a University of Michigan graduate with ties to the Purple Rose that go way back. Scott Pohl is here with more on this new drama. What's going on here, Scott?
Well, Mark, as you'll hear, this is the story of a May-December romance. To learn more, I spoke with the artistic director at the Purple Rose, Guy Sanville, and Mark Colson. Mark is the MSU theater professor who has the only male role in Gaps in the Fossil Record, opposite Purple Rose veteran Michelle Mountain and a young actress named Asia Brandmeier. Guy Sanville and Mark Colson, welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Thanks for having us here.
I want to ask you initially, just for a synopsis of the story here, what's going on in Gaps in the Fossil Record? Guy?
Well, Gaps in the Fossil Record is about a 60-ish year old paleontologist who... The short version is it's about a man who learns to look up. He spends his whole life, you know, dusting bones and looking in the dirt. And he falls in love with one of his students who is about 40 years younger than he is. And the play starts with her bringing him home to meet mom, who was a single mom. And it's also about the gaps that exists not just in the fossil record, but, you know, in our lives. And it's very funny and very, very poignant.
People of a certain age are sometimes referred to as fossils. Mark, are you the fossil of this story?
I am definitely. I get referred to as a fossil as well. Yeah.
What appealed to you about this story, Mark?
When I first read the script, a guy sent it to me, and it's a really complex script, and so you need to read it about three or four times before you really start to get it. And so the first time that I read it, I was like, now what's this piece about? And, you know, who's even the protagonist? I mean, I didn't even know that it was sort of me at that point. I thought it might have been, you know, one of the other characters or the character of Susan. But it's a huge journey for an actor to make, you know, and so... that's the thing that was really interested me more than anything else, you know, that I really have a I have years to cover in this piece, you know, 12 years, 14 years, 16 years. Also it was also the opportunity to work with Guy again, and we hadn't worked together for 24 years or something like that. And so to reconnect with him, that really interested me as well. And this, the subject matter of this piece and the material was really the thing that drew me to it.
We have a little bit of audio from the online trailer that Purple Rose Theater has that you can go look at to get some a feel for what it's like to see Gaps in the Fossil Record.
She can't possibly understand how important this moment. It is impossible for her to understand because she's too
young. She's too damn young.
Guy, I wanted to ask you about Matt Lesher. Tell us about him, not just as an actor. People perhaps are familiar with him as an actor, but he's from Michigan, Grosse Pointe, went to Michigan. Describe Matt Lesher, the actor, and the playwright for us.
Well, Matt and I met in 92. We both did he just graduated from college. We were both cast in a new play by Jeff Daniels called The Tropical Pickle, a comedy. And you just, I mean, you see certain people and you just know. I mean, this guy was, and then he got a small role in Gettysburg and moved to Los Angeles and pretty much has been working ever since he got there. He's done a lot of film, a lot of television. You can see him currently in a television show on the CW called The Flash. He's playing the Reverse Flash. And he's one of the smartest people I've ever known. And we did a movie together a long time ago, and we did this we played this movie star game where you take your middle name and the street you grew up on, and that's your movie star name. Mine was Richard Deerfield, and we shot a lot at night, and we were all playing in these characters and doing these phony 40s Hollywood accents. And he went and wrote a play about that, about these characters called Sea of Fools, which is a hilarious farce that we did. And then he sent me this play back in 08, and I was afraid of it the first time I saw it. I wasn't ready for it. And we did some workshops, and then we decided to do it. And we got a great, it won an Edgerton Award for new plays. And he's, you know, he makes his home in Los Angeles. He's a Michigan guy, and he loves to write plays, and we're working on another one with him right now. And he gets home very often. He was very involved in the process, did some great rewrites the 2 weeks during previews, and the play's changed a lot since I first saw it. But he's the real deal.
How much would you say the play changed during those 2 weeks of previews, Mark? It's interesting. I'm not sure people fully realize how much a story can change or the plotting of a play can change during the preview section of a world premiere.
Yeah, it changed quite a bit. You know, and that's the terrifying thing of working on a new work, and that's the exciting thing about working on a new piece is that, you know, we're really trying to shape this thing to get it, you know, so that it's going to be, you know, sort of palatable to an audience or that we're telling the story in the right way. And so the scary thing for an actor is that we would, you know, we'd get rewrites at night and then come back in the morning or come back the next day, and then we'd try to make these things happen. And sometimes, especially with the preview thing, sometimes we'd have a bit of rehearsal beforehand that we could try to work these things in, you know, and sometimes it was just some, you know, a question of winging it a little bit, you know. I think the last monologue, I want to say that was... that was sort of a major rewrite. I want to say that was 2 days before we opened that we got that rewrite, something in that
neighborhood. Actually, we're very lucky. We get to do 7 previews before our press opening, which is unheard of. And we got a major rewrite in that last speech. And we didn't have any rehearsal time, so it was we do 2 shows on Saturday and then 1 on Sunday, and then we have a Tuesday rehearsal. We were planning on putting that in. So I'm watching the Sunday preview, and Mark's doing the last speech, and he put in the rewrite, and it was, you know, he was 2 days ahead of schedule. It was awesome, but that was an awesome surprise. I think it helps if you choose to embrace the romance, because it can be terrifying. But that whole idea, I mean, he made several significant changes, and on the page it might have just been, you know, 5 or 6 lines, but it changed everything. And it was really, really exciting. We did a lot of work on the script. You know, we cut probably 15 pages. That's not uncommon in the early drafts because usually everybody overwrites, you know. It is a process of distillation. I believe that what you leave out is just as important as what you keep. After the first five previews, we do post-show discussions, talkbacks with the audience. They're very smart, and we learn a lot. We learn a lot watching the show with them. They're our partners in this thing. But we also, you know, listen to them, and they have a real hand in helping us shape the work. So it's pretty cool.
And Gaps in the Fossil Record is up for an important award now.
It's going to be nominated for the George and Mimi Steinberg Award, which is given to the best new American play produced outside of New York City. It'll be our eighth nomination at the Purple Rose, and very excited about that.
Good luck.
Thank you.
We're talking with Guy Sanville, the artistic director at the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea, and Mark Colson is also with us. He has the lead role in the world premiere of Gaps in the Fossil Record, which is at the Purple Rose through May 28th. Mark, tell me about the two actors you work with in this show.
Michelle Mountain and Asia Brandmeier are great. Michelle is one of the best listeners that I've ever been on stage with, that she really, whatever changes are made, whatever, you know, inflections or different sort of emotional things you're going through, she's really, really perceptive. And Asia is one of the scenes that we do, it's towards the end. You know, we just have a really, really lovely time connecting with one another. She's a young actress. I mean, she was a little scared of it as well because I think most of her work has been done in film. But she's amazing. She's killer.
Guy Sanville, your founder, Jeff Daniels, has been nominated for a Tony Award. He's been on Broadway for a couple of months now in Blackbird with Michelle Williams. The Tony Awards will be on June 12th, another feather in the cap for everyone who is associated with Jeff Daniels at the Purple Rose.
Yeah, Jeff is, we just couldn't be happier for him. You know, he's an old school theater guy. This is his second time with this play. You know, back in the old days, somebody would do out-of-town tryouts, and then they'd run a show on Broadway for a year or two, and then they'd do the tour. Well, he did God of Carnage for 2 years. He played both male roles. I mean, he's very committed to the theater. I mean, you know, he built a great theater here in Michigan, and he keeps going back to the stage, and we just couldn't be happier for him. He's very deserving of every accolade that comes his way.
I have a question for each of you about the life in the theater, and in your case specifically, Guy, I want to ask you about how busy this life keeps you, because you just got done acting in The Odd Couple at the Purple Rose while getting ready to direct Gaps in the Fossil Record, and I'm sure there was some overlap there.
We got an extra, because of the Edgerton Award, we got an extra week of rehearsal, so there were 3 weeks of overlap, and that was insane. But once you get in the room and you're around all these incredibly smart, gifted people, all that goes away. I think I have the best job in America. Yeah, I work a lot, but I live two blocks away from there, and I get to spend my days with amazing people doing, you know, telling stories. So it's I'm very fortunate.
And Mark Colson, you're on the faculty in theater here at Michigan State University, so you're going back and forth to Chelsea. I know you travel to act from time to time to places like Pittsburgh, and specifically I know you go to from time to time.
Yeah.
You're always on the go, too.
Yeah, it's pretty much nonstop. But my commitment has always been to my acting career. I mean, yes, I'm a professor here, and that is very, very important to me, and passing on the knowledge that I have learned. But I think that it's also really, really important for me that I remain a teaching artist, because I think the thing that gives me credibility in the classroom is the work that I do outside of there. And so definitely I want my students to come and see this piece of work down in down at the Purple Rose, just because I'm really, really proud of it. Yes, I was on time with Banshee on Cinemax that that just ran. Outsiders just finished up, and then I just found out that I'm going to be going back for the second season of Outsiders as well. So it's, you know, keeps me on my toes.
Outstanding. Gaps in the Fossil Record is at the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea until May 28th. We've been talking with their artistic director, Guy Sanville, and Mark Colson, who is the star, I think I could safely say.
We're an ensemble down
it's
there.
It's an ensemble. Yeah. Okay.
There's only three of us.
He's the guy.
The only male.
I'm the guy.
The only he's male the guy. Character.
Are you sure I'm the guy?
He's the guy.
In Gaps in the Fossil Record by Matt Lesher. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, attorney Brian Jackson is one of six candidates running for Ingham County prosecutor in August. He'll be the second candidate to come on Current State to discuss his platform and why he's running. That's on the way on Current State. Don't forget, our next pop-up stories event happens Wednesday, the 25th at the Robin Theater. The theme will be the birds and the bees. Check out our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. If you'd like more information, we've got room for storytellers. And, of course, you can always just join the audience and listen to the other storytellers as well. Pop-Up Stories Lansing on our Facebook page. Longtime WKAR radio reader host Dick Estelle died on Friday morning. Estelle passed away 2 months after retiring from the show. He was still reading in his 90th year. Dick was born and raised in Hillsdale. The U.S. Air Force veteran worked in commercial radio for 5 years, and he became WKAR radio manager in 1962. The Radio Reader was among the first of NPR's syndicated features in the early 1970s. Back in 2014, Dick celebrated his half century of hosting the show. In this Current State interview excerpt, Dick Estelle reflects on the impact of the Radio Reader.
Well, the Radio Reader has meant to me, has given me an opportunity to read books. And I've taken advantage of that opportunity. And that's what the program is all about. The program actually started back in the very early 30s. And the manager of the station, Bob Coleman, at that time started the program. It was the Reading Circle, I believe, and was 15 minutes long.
Okay.
But the same thing. He would read from a book. And then it expanded to a half hour. And when Bob Coleman retired, then Larry Freimeyer, who became manager, was the next radio reader. So actually I inherited the program from the two previous managers of the station.
Whoever was manager was the Radio Reader.
That was it.
Okay.
In the beginning, it was a program only for WKAR. Little by little, it became a national program.
Hmm.
Then with the satellite coming in, it offered us so much more opportunity.
How proud were you of the fact that you were national?
Well, very proud.
Yeah.
I was one of the originators of National Public Radio. As I said, it was called just educational radio in the beginning, and then National Public Radio. And I served as the chairman of the board of directors for a while. And I was, as I said, was very proud of that, and still am today, because National Public Radio has become a major source of national and international news around the nation.
Dick Estelle, former WKAR manager and longtime Radio Reader host. Dick Estelle died Friday at the age of 90. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. This July, Stuart Dunnings III will be resigning as the Ingham County prosecutor. On August 2nd, six candidates' names will appear on a primary ballot to try to replace him. One Democrat and one Republican will then face off in the November general election. That winner will serve Ingham County as prosecutor from January 1st through the end of 2020. Current State's reaching out to all the candidates to invite them to discuss why they're running and what they hope to bring to the office. Today we're joined by Democrat, Lansing native, Brian Jackson. Brian's the owner of Jackson Law PLLC, and he formerly worked in the Eaton County Prosecutor's Office and is a Lansing Assistant City Attorney. Brian Jackson, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Why are you running for prosecutor?
Thank you, Mark. I'm running for a variety of reasons. Mainly being from Lansing and Ingham County, I've got to know the people, and I love the people. I think we're generally hardworking, honest, and ultimately I want to keep people safe, and I think that I have great ideas to do that.
Can you share a few of them?
Yes, there's full discretion as a prosecutor. He has, or she has, the most discretion probably in the criminal justice system and is the most influential. And I would balance fairness, victims' rights, and even some of the needs of the offender to ultimately try to reduce recidivism, which will keep people safer. There's different techniques that I would employ. Restorative justice is a main thing that I would look into and try to use widely. Different diversion programs, but mainly being concerned and balancing serious repeat offenders with more violent crimes compared to nonviolent, maybe first-time or young offenders and how we treat them through the system.
Broadly, would you say then, Brian, that the system doesn't fairly discriminate between those two? Too often lesser crimes get lumped into a more serious category?
Yeah, that's a basic generalization. And again, it's a lot up to the prosecutor and his or her policies. And then the judges kind of take it from there. But we kind of make the framework for that. And really, incarceration is one of the harshest punishments that our system has. So I would seek to, fairly discriminate between those type of offenses.
Mm-hmm. The charges against Stuart Dunnings aside, what do you think of the way the prosecutor's office is run today? What do you think they do well? What do you think they should be doing better?
Thank you. I don't have any complaints about the prosecutor's office per se, because again, the head prosecutor makes generally the policies that the assistants and the subordinates follow. And I haven't had any negative experiences per se with any of the assistants or the way they handle business, but I would seek to kind of use more discretion and look towards alternatives to incarceration, and again try to balance how we treat people.
So Prosecutor Dunnings hasn't used that kind of discretion in the past. He's been too aggressive in his role as prosecutor. Is that what you're saying?
I don't want to go that far, but I think that there is room for more balance and more fairness.
How did your experience in the Eaton County prosecutor's office prepare you in any way for this job?
Well, it's in a prosecutor's office, and I prosecuted cases, misdemeanors, worked on felonies, and learned the system enough to see that there are problems and flaws with the system. And I think it gave me a insight on ways to do things well. For example, in Eaton County, they handle victims' rights very well, and they're very accountable to the victim of a crime. But also, things I may do a little differently is I could take into account more the individual offense, the individual offender, some of the collateral consequences to prosecution and incarceration, and consider those as a whole.
I'm speaking with Brian Jackson, owner of Jackson Law PLLC. Brian is one of six candidates running for Ingham County prosecutor here. The primary is coming up on August 2nd. What about your time as an assistant city attorney in the city of Lansing? What'd you learn in that position that might inform your work as county prosecutor?
Absolutely. One of the main jobs I had was to prosecute the city ordinance cases, and those are generally less serious than state crimes. And what I did notice is that a lot of people, there's a wide range of people that get involved in the system for one reason or another, and that the collateral consequences that they face, for example, losing their license for a year at sometimes could cause them to lose a job, cause them to be set back in so many different ways. And I would take into account those collateral consequences, such as losing your license or losing your job or being evicted from your home, things that happen once you're sometimes convicted, and take that into account as I decide what type of pleas and policy to move forward on.
You've said you're an adherent of restorative justice here. Explain what restorative justice means and how you feel about that approach.
Thank you. Restorative justice is a technique of prosecution or justice that derived from a variety of reform movements. It's basically repairing the harm caused by criminal behavior, and it would bring offenders, victims, community members, and the government together to decide how to move forward and repair the harm. One thing that's different than the traditional justice system is that it requires an admission of guilt up front, because the offender has to basically admit that he or she did this so that harm can be repaired moving forward.
How often have you worked on cases where you feel like a restorative justice approach would be beneficial? Are there a lot of cases that might fall under that umbrella, or is it a less common kind of scenario that would invite this restorative justice approach?
That's a good question. I've worked on plenty of cases that I feel could be a good candidate for restorative justice. There needs to be a distinction, though, between a type of criteria for which people or cases move into that type of diversion program. And again, violent offenses, repeat offenders, habitual offenders, they may not qualify for a restorative justice program. But again, young people, especially first-time offenders and nonviolent offenses, would be more likely to fit in the restorative justice realm.
You're the youngest candidate running for prosecutor. You've said you see that as an asset. If a county resident walked up to you and said, Brian, I want someone with experience in that office, with more experience than a 32-year-old, what would you say to try to change their mind?
Oh, thank you. That's a good question. I'm sure that it's going to come up in the future, but mainly I would say that I've been a prosecutor long enough, and I've been in a criminal attorney long enough to notice the problems that are associated with the criminal justice system, whether it's fairness, the fact that crime rates aren't necessarily decreasing, and recidivism, which is reoffending, is still up. So noticing the problems is one thing, but then being able to adapt and bring in new ideas, I think I'll be best suited for that. And that's what I'll do, bring in the new ideas, adapt to the changes, and be energized to move forward.
When you worked for the city, did you work more in a prosecutorial role then? Was that the majority of the work that you did?
Yeah, it's at least 50%, but probably a majority. There was other civil defense and other type of work I did with the city, but I mainly worked in the district court doing prosecutorial work.
We're running out of time here, but I do want to ask you about your thoughts on mental health, which is another part of your platform. Why is that an issue you want to address?
The mentally ill, they fill our jails and prisons, and a lot of times they need treatment and can't necessarily control some of their behavior. And I think that if we treat them more medically than criminally, we'll free up resources to concentrate on the more severe crimes, and also will get that person, that offender, help that he or she needs and make them less likely to reoffend and ultimately keep Ingham County residents safer.
I've been speaking with Brian Jackson, owner of Jackson Law in Lansing. Brian's one of six candidates running for Ingham County prosecutor this fall. We're extending invitations to all of the candidates to be on Current State between now and the August primary. Brian Jackson, good luck.
Thank you.
Well, the 142nd Kentucky Derby took place over the weekend, and there was no horsing around for the thoroughbred Nyquist, who took home the crown. Now, the name Nyquist rings a bell for fans of Detroit Red Wings hockey, seeing as though the horse was named after Detroit Red Wings forward Gustav Nyquist. And speaking of Detroit teams, the Tigers were left wishing that the weekend magic of Nyquist would have rubbed off on them. The club has now lost six straight after a weekend sweep at the hands of the Texas Rangers. Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, joins us now.
Mark, how you doing?
A different kind of weekend with the Kentucky Derby.
Yes.
And, boy, the Tigers seem to be on a real swoon here early in the season. Let's start with the Tigers. I mean, you and I were here a week ago. They had just come off winning six straight. What's happened in the past 7 days?
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark. What I always say with the game of baseball, she loves me, she loves me not, okay? And right now the Tigers have clearly picked the wrong pedal when looking at this weekend series against the Texas Rangers. An 8-3 loss, as you mentioned, now six straight losses. But it's so interesting, Mark, because, you know, again, last week when I was on, when the Tigers were, when they had that five-game win streak, a big component as to why they were in a groove, if you will, was because of their bullpen. Their bullpen didn't even allow a run last weekend. But if you look at what occurred yesterday, it was quite the opposite. Justin Verlander, this is something I've harped on all year, with the exception of Jordan Zimmermann, who's a starting pitcher for the Detroit Tigers. For the most part, the starting pitcher for the Tigers has been a bit shoddy. Yesterday, it was absolutely fantastic. We saw Justin Verlander show shades of the Justin Verlander of the past. He allowed three hits over, seven scoreless innings. He struck out nine. And also, JV passed a bit of a milestone here. He moved past, actually, Jack Morris into sole possession of second place on the Tigers' all-time strikeouts list. And we all know that Mickey Lolich is the all-time leader. So JV goes out there, has a fantastic game up until the eighth inning. And that's when Brad Ausmus, third-year manager for the Detroit Tigers, decided to go to his bullpen. And then everything just completely explodes on him. You saw in that eighth inning, seven runs were scored.
Yeah.
Brad Ausmus went to Justin Wilson and Mark Lowe in the eighth. And, you know, Bobby Wilson, an interesting tie there. Bobby Wilson is the guy who really gave the Rangers the lead in that inning. If you remember a few weeks ago, Bobby Wilson was a Detroit Tiger who has now signed a contract with the Texas Rangers. He's the guy who really started that rally for him. And then, you know, Francisco Rodriguez, he comes in the ninth and gives up a run. So we saw the bullpen completely destroy a gem from Justin Verlander yesterday, Mark.
What about our offense?
The offense, and this is the thing. You heard a lot of chatter when concerning Brad Ausmus on the hot seat this year. He's in his third year, and justifiably so. I mean, this is a roster that is built, when you look at it on paper, that is built to compete for a World Series, if not win one, and hasn't yet. They're going on they've been on the roller coaster all season, but you can't put all this on Brad Ausmus, though, especially yesterday, Mark, because when you talk about hitting, J.D. Martinez, he goes 0-4. Anthony Gose, he struck out three times, Mark. Victor Martinez and Justin Upland, they go hitless the entire game. If you want to compete for World Series championships, your stars have to show up, and that clearly did not happen yesterday.
So it's not just the bullpen.
Not just the bullpen.
We're struggling at the plate as well. To get to the Kentucky Derby, Nyquist was not a horse who got the acclaim of American Pharoah last year, even though Nyquist was the favorite. How come?
Well, I tell you what, Mark, anytime a horse wins a triple crown, the hype is so real that it's hard to duplicate that. Now, I say that, I'm going to kind of try to, you know, kind of contradict myself with this statement here, because when you look at the last triple crown winners before American Pharoah last year, Mark, back-to-back years, the feat was accomplished. If you remember, back in 1977 and the following year in 1978, Seattle Slough and Affirmed won it back-to-back years. But it's such a crazy feat to think about one horse winning, again, the top three races in horse racing to claim the Triple Crown. It's so rare that lightning strikes twice, even though it did back in the 70s. So that's why when you look at this year, American Pharoah just won it. Can a horse really follow up what American Pharoah did? So that's the reason why I believe that Nyquist isn't getting the hype that American Pharoah did last year. But at the same time, it was so impressive what Nyquist has done this year, and again, winning the Kentucky Derby in the length that he did, it was pretty impressive, Mark.
Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports. Al's got more this afternoon at 1 p.m. and every weekday at 1 on AM 870 WKAR in Current Sports TV, which airs every Thursday night at 10:30 on WKAR-TV. Al will have more on the Kentucky Derby, the Tigers, and lots more this afternoon. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, next year marks the landmark 100th season of the Flint Symphony Orchestra's existence. We'll speak with Maestro Enrique Domecq to learn a few of the highlights of the 2016-17 season as this great ensemble looks forward and looks back over the past century of music making. That and more Tuesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.